The opinions and views expressed in Dead Men Do Tell Tales and all affiliated media are Jordan and Nicole's and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of their training program or others working in the field of medico-legal death investigation.
Hey everyone,
welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales,
a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
How many times have we done this?
43, because this is number 44.
Well, and then our interim episodes and that we haven't. Oh, I guess we don't do the intro for those though.
No, we don't.
Anyway, yeah. What are we?
We're a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
I'm Nicole Kroom.
And I'm Jordan Taylor.
And we're both pathology residents who are going into forensic pathology.
And we haven't even had our first sip of whiskey yet.
I mean, it's been open, so maybe the fumes caused your brain to fizzle.
You know what I'm going to blame it on? All of the studying I've been doing. Because, so, as Nicole and I said in our little, like, two-minute spiel, boards are coming up very soon, which is this giant test that we have to take. And it's essentially packing a ton of information into your brain, and my brain is dying very slowly.
Yes, they can test you on anything you quote-unquote learned during residency, which is everything from forensics to micro to chemistry.
And then there's random, like, diseases that you haven't thought about since med school. It's like, what chemistry test would be the best one to run? And you're like, I have absolutely no idea. I would Google it normally, which I have access to, but I don't right now.
Yeah.
So dumb. So we both need a drink. And so today, I like that one a lot.
This one has a very interesting smell.
Ooh. So we're having the last of the four of the whiskeys that Rob got me for Christmas. This one is a single malt Scotch whiskey. And it's a Leydig is the distillery, and it's aged 19 years.
This is 19 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Yeah. Some of the other ones actually were older. This is the youngest one. The other ones were 27, 26, and 20.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel not deserving enough to drink such aged fare.
Do you want the description of this one?
Of course I do. This one, with that dartboard.
This one actually I feel like is the most legitimate of them. So a punchy, peated expression from the Tobermory Distillery on the Isle of Mull.
Mull?
Punchy, peaty.
I love the alliteration.
The nose is smoky with cinnamon and warming spice.
Don't get that cinnamon, but I get the smoky.
I get the warming spice too. Mm. Palate is sweet with peppery spice.
Sweet.
Yeah. A little bit. And then the finish is lingering spice, tingling with a final smoky taste, which I do get.
Yeah. Yeah, that smoke, definitely. It reminds me of mezcal.
Kind of.
The whiskey version.
But the whiskey version, yeah. I like the smoky. I think I like smoky whiskeys more. Note. So, our episode today, we are not going to straight up read out of Dr. Lefkowitz's anatomic pathology study guide, but we have heavily taken notes from the points that he thinks are important on forensics topics that we are going to teach back today. So we're not going to actually, you know, read the questions and answer the questions, but we're going to talk about the important learning points around a lot of these questions. So hopefully if you are maybe studying for the boards or are interested in what they care about testing forensic pathologists, you'll have a vague idea of, you know, what's important.
It's also a good recap of a lot of the topics we've talked about, I noticed. Yeah, although there were some where I was like, oh, we haven't covered gunshots, which is a big topic for us not to have covered.
Yeah. It'll happen.
Yeah.
And on that note, that's actually what we're going to start with.
Yep.
So one of the important questions that they always have with gunshot wounds is how close was the gun to the person? And there's a few things that we could use to help determine that. And the most important point is when a bullet gets fired, it's more than just the bullet that leaves the gun.
Yep.
So there's the bullet, there's gas, and there's also this burnt and unburnt powder grains, which we in common nomenclature called gunshot residue or GSR. And how close the gun is to the body determines, you know, what we can see on the body. Because you can imagine if you're close, different things will get deposited than if you're really far. So I'm going to start right up against the body and I'm going to slowly step back. So for contact, when the gun muzzle is actually touching the skin, you'll actually get this muzzle stamp, which is an imprint of the muzzle on the skin. It's kind of a burnt outline of what the muzzle looked like is the best way to describe it.
Now, like a brand.
It's a brand. You're branded by the gun.
Yes.
Bad news bears. But all the other stuff that I mentioned, like the gas and the gunshot residue, don't get spread. They go directly into the body. So you don't get some of the remnants of the gas and the GSR that you do from these other ones. So contact, muzzle imprint. That's all you really need to remember. The next category is close. And close means within 6 inches of the skin or, you know, yeah, we'll just say, we're going to pretend right now we're just shooting directly onto skin. I'll talk about if you go through fabric later. But if you, you know, get shot in the arm or the side of the face or something, if you're between 6 inches and touching, there are two distinct things that you're going to see. One of which is called fouling. So this is like dust-like burnt powder grains that can be easily wiped off. So this is kind of like a...
Also known as soot.
Or yeah, soot or fouling. And so it's like the stuff that you have to wipe off from like a fireplace that kind of covers your hands. Yeah. And that only happens when you're within 6 inches. So if you see fouling, you are within 6 inches of the body from where the gun was fired. The next thing is called stippling. So that's the unburnt powder grains that hit the skin and cause a superficial injury. Now, like I said, the fouling or the soot can be wiped off. Stippling cannot be wiped off. And it kind of looks like these numerous pinpoint abrasion type injuries. And fouling will cover about 6 inches, which is why when you're more than 6 inches, you don't see fouling. But stippling can travel up to 30 inches. So those are the important cut points, 6 inches and 30 inches, because once you're between 6 inches and 30 inches, you'll still see that stippling. You'll still see that like the pinpoint abrasion type marks, but you're not going to see fouling anymore. So intermediate is between 6 inches and 30 inches and you see stippling only. And then the last category is distant. So that's more than 30 inches. And with that, you don't see fouling or stippling. Essentially, you just see the hole. The two important things to keep note here are every gun is different, and the gold standard to determining range of fire is testing each gun individually because they do change. And the other really important thing to note is if something is in the way between the gun and the skin, you might not see the muzzle stamp, fouling, or stippling. So if I hold a gun right against a shirt into a body and fire, it might be a contact injury, but I won't see any of those three things, so I can't call it correctly. So essentially, if you're shot through something, you can't tell range of fire.
Yeah. You might be able to see some evidence on the clothing itself, but yes, it's not as accurate an estimate as seeing the things on the body. Exactly. And clothing can be removed.
Yes.
Or, you know, anything.
Tampering evidence.
Yeah.
The other thing with that was like, that was, you know, anything solid. So also if you get shot through a window, through a door, through anything that can stop those solid particles, you're not going to see those things.
Yes. Which brings up another category, which is indeterminate, meaning we cannot determine due to some interfering thing. So we can't provide an estimate.
Yes.
And key thing with that is don't mistake intermediate for indeterminate on a test.
Yes, that is a good point.
Yeah.
I didn't think about that until you just said indeterminate while I was reading intermediate. And I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
Because you know they would mess you up, be like contact, close, indeterminate, distant, intermediate. Just to be like total idiots.
Yeah. Yeah. That takes us into more things about gunshot wounds. We alternated who was going to talk about each topic based on the odds versus evens. Yes. So the next question was asking about more things about contact wounds. depending on the part of the body where you get shot, the contact wound can also have a different appearance.
Yes.
So if you're just shot on your skin, when those gases release, sometimes they can cause carbon monoxide to deposit in your skin and you get a cherry red color. So that can also be a hint of contact. But if it's on an area of the body where the skin is really close to the bone, so say, for instance, the skull, then that contact can cause a tearing of the skin at the point of entrance.
Yes.
In a star-shaped or stellate pattern.
Explosion.
So these lacerations happen because the gases are exploding out of the gun and they're getting trapped between the skin and the bone because the bone is so close to the surface. Mm-hmm. And so the skin is kind of ripped away from the bone by the gases and this causes tearing.
It's called a blowback laceration, which I thought was a fun name.
Yes. And this can make entrance wounds resemble exit wounds, because exit wounds, like, characteristically have the stellate appearance.
Yeah, so the key, the general thing is entrance wounds look like a bullet hole. Yep. Like, they look like the hole. And exit wounds, you can, what we say, reapproximate it. So if you put all the edges back together, you can be like, oh, look, that's what the skin looked like before.
Yes. So this can kind of confuse people, but on a cursory examination, because it kind of looks like an exit wound. But these stellate lacerations is what they're called. You can get from contact wound, part of the body close to skin close to bone.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Next one is also firearm related. So this one is talking about shotgun pellets and range of estimation with shotgun pellets. And what is different about a shotgun than a gun? There's a lot. A shotgun is a long gun with a smooth bore, and it fires these little tiny pellets, and those little tiny pellets are hard together, or held, or those small pellets.
Herded together by the tube of the gun, like a shepherd.
Shepherd you into the body. Yeah. And go, poof, poof.
Oh, man. My flock of pellets.
Be free.
Don't shoot people.
Please don't shoot people. We don't need more work. The pandemic and the opioid pandemic have already given us enough.
Yeah.
Epidemic. It would be an epidemic. Pellets. These small pellets are held together in this little thing called a wadding, which is either made of plastic or cardboard. And that's inside the shotgun shell. So when you have a shotgun, you have this giant, or not giant, but like a good-sized metal shell. And inside of that, there is this wadding. And inside that, there are all the little tiny pellets. So when a shotgun gets fired, the shotgun shell comes out, and then the wadding comes out, and then the pellets kind of fan out. Now, you would think that you could say, oh, well, you know, we can then and take the gun and look at it from the side and see how far spread the pellets were, and when they hit the body, you know, that'll probably be about the same. We can guess how far away the shotgun was from the body based on the angle of the spray of these shotgun shells.
Educated guess.
But that, in fact, is not how that happened at all. Because essentially, once these shells hit the body, they do what's called the billiard ball effect. So once they hit the skin, they just kind of explode out even more than they did already in the air. So when you're opening in billiards, right, you hit the cue ball, and it hits all of the other balls in the triangle. And even though you're only hitting that first ball, they all explode around the billiards table, right?
You're much better at pool than I am.
You just kind of like lightly hit it and then they just sit there.
The eight ball goes directly into the hole.
Yeah. Okay. And then the cue ball follows it.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happens in the body with these pellets is you'll have a pellet enter the body, like the first pellet that comes out, let's say, enters the body. And then the pellet behind it hits that pellet because obviously it's slowed down when it hits the body. And that one from behind is going to send that pellet in some random direction. So you can't judge the angle and the quote-unquote explosion of the pellets within the body based on where that gun was, because once the pellets hit the body, they kind of just explode and fan out within the body relatively randomly. So long story short, you can't tell from a body or from an x-ray of these shotgun pellets exactly how far the shotgun was from the body. So this is always going to be indeterminate for range of fire, unless you have these other things like the soot and whatnot. But you can't be like, oh, it was fanned out on this angle, therefore the gun must have been this far. Different. Yeah.
So now to change course away from gunshot wounds, mm-hmm. we're going to talk a little bit about patterns of injury, which are things that we use to help determine cause of death, potential weapons that might have been used, some of the times the circumstances surrounding the death, and more. Specifically talking about blunt force injury to begin with, which we have covered in a different episode. But blunt force injury can cause lots of different patterns that we can see on the body. And one of the more important ones is lacerations, which are tears that are produced by a blunt force, as opposed to a tear that is caused by a sharp object being dragged across the skin, which is an incision. So the way to differentiate between blunt force versus sharp force causing this tear is looking at the edges. So if the edges are ragged, it's more likely to be a laceration because you're not getting that sharp-edged thing making a clean tear. And then also something called tissue bridging. And so the nerves and the vessels are a lot stronger than the skin and the adipose tissue. So they stay intact when that blunt force happens. And you can see them bridging across the wound is what they call it. So that's one of the ways you can tell the difference between a laceration and an incision.
So sharp force injuries, as Nicole has said most of this already, they're caused by a sharp object with a smooth and straight edge. So the key here is no tissue bridging because you're cutting through the skin. So the two types of sharp force injuries are stab wounds and incisions. And the only thing you need to know at that are stab wounds are deeper than they are long and incisions are longer than they are deep. Kind of makes sense. And that does come up in some of the other questions, but yeah, this one was pretty quick.
Yeah. The next teaching point is kind of a mix between cause versus manner and also tying in with the patterns of injury, helping to determine what a manner is. So as we've talked about numerous times, cause versus manner, cause of death is the injury, disease, or combination of the two which led to the death. And we can further break that down into immediate versus proximate. Not sure that's important right now. And then manner are the circumstances under which the death occurred. And we categorize that either as natural, homicide, suicide, accident, or undetermined. And so a lot of the forensic questions are getting you to pick a cause or a manner, but then they'll list like one of the other as options to kind of throw you off and make sure that you really know what the difference is between cause versus manner. So one of the characteristic patterns of injury that we can see in patients who commit suicide, trigger warning, we were discussing suicide in this episode, is something called hesitation marks. And these are superficial incisions that you can see on different parts of the body, more classically on the wrist, in cases of suicide. So this is somebody who maybe made some attempts before they get their final cut. And so this is a photo they like to show of the inside surface of the wrist with multiple horizontal incisions on it. And suicide is a manner, not a cause.
So the next one, there's a bunch of questions that are just kind of really specific and you need to know things that are associated with different mechanisms of injury and that type of thing. So one of the pretty unique things that you'll see in forensics but nowhere else is a descent from height injury when you hit the ground feet first. Mm. And this is just a distinct pattern of injury that you have to know how to recognize. And in this case, it was a person who had, you kind of got a shot from the bottom, and there were lacerations on his heels. And as we said, lacerations are from blunt force impact. So this guy had a blunt force impact on the bottom of his heels. And you also could see that he had some fractures on his calf. So he had these lacerations on the bottom of his heel. So obviously hit his heel, and then he has broken tib fib, the calf bones. So what happened? And so in this case, you know, this is a descent from height feet first. So you fall from high, you hit feet first. Nothing else is going to cause that much force on the bottom of your feet except for something like that. Other things that you can see in this that are important to know make sense from the fact that, like, you have, you know, if you picture a person standing up and you hit your feet really hard, that force kind of translates up the body. So you can also see vertebral fractures, ring fractures in the base of the skull, because the vertebra will, your spine will stay pretty common, will stay pretty solid, but like your skull can keep moving a little bit more. So you get a fracture around the ring where your skull kind of attaches to your spine. And, you know, there's a bunch of other things as well, but that's kind of a unique pattern of injury. And this is important to contrast with a pedestrian that was hit by a car, because a pedestrian that was hit by a car will have the so-called bumper fractures, which are the calf, the tib-fib fractures, but they won't have those lacerations on the bottom of the heel from that blunt force impact. So this is kind of like bringing out the differential of those two and knowing what those random lacerations on the bottom of somebody's heel might be.
Okay. More patterns of injury. Talking about blood in the eyes. So one of the things...
Eyeballs.
So the picture for this question was petechial hemorrhages, which we discussed in our asphyxia episode, but this is pinpoint bleeding. So the red specks or dots that can be seen on the face or the eyes. Specifically, this photo is showing the conjunctiva, which is that inner eyelid skin, which, you know, you only see if you're being creepy to your friends and like flipping your eyelids inside out.
Yes, exactly.
And it happens in neck or chest compression or other circumstances where there is not constant occlusion of the vessels. So you're getting intermittent blood flow to the areas of the body that are kind of being choked off. So you can see them in things like strangulation, but also CPR, and then Valsalva maneuver. And that's what you do when you're trying to pop your ears, essentially, like close your mouth and then blow. So
I always think of it as like bearing down too.
Yes. Bearing down with things like lifting, giving birth, vigorous coughing or vomiting can all cause these petechiae to show up.
Pooping.
Eat fiber, drink water.
Life skills.
And this is versus something called retinal hemorrhage, and it occurs in the back of the eyes. So you're not going to see it when you're examining the decedent's eyes from the front. And the back of the eyes is where your retina is. And so you can... It's retinal hemorrhage. So yeah, it's in where the retina is, in the back of the eye. And you can see it secondary to whiplash. So it strong acceleration deceleration forces cause tearing of the very delicate vessels of your retina. And so you can also see it in things like shaken baby syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big keyword for shaken baby syndrome is retinal hemorrhages.
Yes.
So, trigger warning, talking about suicide again. One of the important points in forensic pathology is ligature marks. So the ligature is the cord or the thing that is used around the neck to cause compression. And the furrow is that groove in the tissue that's caused by that material. And important parts with ligatures and furrows is that this kind of covers a broad category, right? This could be suicide or homicide. You can hang yourself or you can hang somebody else.
Or accident.
That's your... Actually, that was one of my issues I had with this question, which we'll get to in a minute. Within the use of ligatures, it kind of is brought into two groups. There's hanging, where the body weight is what tightens a ligature. And of note, complete suspension isn't necessary. One of the first cases I had when I was an EMT was a, you know, our age, little younger woman who, you know, sat down in the bathtub with a belt around her neck and killed herself just by sitting down. She could have stood up at any time. You do not need full suspension. And so you have hanging and you have ligature strangulation. So in ligature strangulation, it's the force of something besides gravity, usually a person, but it could also be like a car that is tightening the ligature. So both can be either suicide or homicide. Somebody else can hang you up. You can hang yourself up. Ligature strangulation is probably going to be homicide, but you can also set up something. So like you can make the car go and the car will drive away and tighten the ligature around your neck.
I also had a case where somebody used zip ties. So that's technically
a ligature. Yeah. So usually ligature strangulation though is going to be homicide. Not always. Spinal fractures. This kind of comes up going back to like the Jeffrey Epstein thing. And spinal fractures are rare. Hyoid fractures are rare. These are more common in judicial hangings, which are called drop hangings, because of the strong force of the drop it's just not really that common. And they say that most ligature or hanging deaths in children are accidental. Again, this is always a most. Anything can happen. It's never an always. And I think the answer to this question was, in young children, it's never accidental. In young children, ligature stranglings are never accidental. So they're saying that, essentially, in young children, it's always going to be homicide. But children can catch themselves in cords. There was that case of the girl who didn't die, but in our Halloween episode, she was 17, and she accidentally hung herself on those Halloween decorations in that haunted house.
Now, this one is an except. So it's saying in young children, it's always accidental.
Exactly. But it's not always accidental. The thing is, so like, this is a, so the question is one of those, like, all of these are correct except. And one of them is, in adults, it's never accidental. And the other ones is, in children, it's never accidental. In both populations, it can be accidental.
True.
So, I don't know. This is a bad question.
I agree.
So, essentially, my point is, in adults and children, it can be accidental or suicide or homicide.
Yeah. And they do say that in the...
Yeah. Yeah, but... Which confuses me. It's like, why is that...
Never.
Like, there was... it was just a bad question. But every possibility is essentially there. Even though with kids, it is less likely...
Intentional.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. The next teaching point.
Sorry if that was confusing, guys. I was trying to find a way to put that.
No. That makes sense. I always have trouble with the which one of these statements is false or which one is true.
Yeah, especially when something like this, it leaves, you know, all of these are correct except, but there are two nevers.
Right.
And it's never.
Yeah.
So.
You're not following the test-taking rules.
I think I put, like, the other one of these two as my answer, and I was mad that it was wrong.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, but that one's wrong, too. Whatever. I know forensics, guys.
Yeah. It's the only section I get really good scores on every year.
I still mess stuff up, though.
Because of stuff like this.
Yeah, exactly.
So the next teaching point is really fun.
Yes.
Packing versus drug stuffing.
Yes.
What? So both of these are different ways of hiding drugs in body cavities to evade detection by law enforcement.
Our job is awesome, guys.
Yes. However, the risks and consequences vary depending on the amount and type of drug and the way it's packaged. So drug packing is done to smuggle drugs across borders or other security checkpoints. So the drugs can be placed in packets or in condoms, and then the body packer, aka mule, swallows those. And then the total amount of the drug involved often represents a super lethal, so super, super fatal dose.
Because this is drugs that are supposed to be split among so many people.
Yeah, these are drugs that are being sold on the market.
Exactly. So, and now it's going into one human.
Yes. So any rupture of the packets is a risk for abrupt toxicity and overdose. It can also cause death due to obstruction or intestinal perforation.
This one I thought was cool because I don't think of that as much, but it's a good point.
Yeah, it is. So at autopsy, what we'll see is we'll find packets in the digestive tract, and it's usually a lot of packets because they're trying to get as much drug as possible across that checkpoint. And this is in contrast to drug stuffing, which usually involves much smaller amounts of drugs, and it occurs when somebody swallows drugs or stuffs it into a body cavity, aka the vagina or rectum, because they are about to be apprehended by law enforcement.
Shove it up there.
So this one is not planned, usually. and the amount is usually smaller, but because the drugs are usually less securely wrapped, overdose is still a concern.
And people don't think of it, but mucous membranes, which is what your vaginal and rectal mucosa is, are made to absorb stuff.
Yes.
So it is made to take up all that drug and put it directly into your bloodstream. So you are effed.
Yes. Which is why you hear stories about people like soaking tampons in vodka.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Don't do it. Don't do it.
You hear about it. Does not mean you should try it.
Yes. And so at autopsy, in these cases, we can find packets in the digestive tract, but it'll usually be a much smaller amount, or hidden in body cavities. So always check the cavities.
Always check the butt.
Yep.
Always do the butt check. Actually, when I was on In September, we did a butt check and there were some drugs up there. like little pills and stuff.
Really?
Yeah, there were some drugs up the butt.
Oh, what?
Yep.
The only thing I found when I did butt checks was...
poop?
No, condyloma.
Oh.
There's this one decedent who had lesions all over the genitals.
Warts are fine. Anus it's lesions. Normal. Yeah. Just it's not... Anyway. So going back to episodes that we've talked about some of this stuff, this one reminded me of the... Algor and Livor and Rygor, oh my.
Yes.
So postmortem changes are a huge thing in forensics.
Yeah.
It's really easy, low-lying fruit. It's pretty straightforward. If you know Latin, it helps.
Yeah.
So Algor is temperature. So Algor mortis is the body temperature change after death. And the only thing I want everybody to remember from this is the body goes to the ambient temperature. It doesn't get colder. If you're in a hot environment, it gets hotter. It goes to the ambient temperature, not necessarily down. Technically, there are formulas that you can use to figure out what the temperature change is going to be. If you know the body temperature and the ambient temperature and what the temperature is now, you can like calculate it. There have been a lot of studies that those formulas are kind of not great, and body temperature isn't particularly a helpful way to determine time of death. But anyway, Algor mortis, body temperature. Rigor mortis is the stiffening. So how, like, the muscle stiffness after death. So remember, you start off loosey-goosey, then your muscles tighten up for, and there are time frames that I'm not going to say now because we're going to have a question in the second set that actually goes into the actual time frame, so I don't want to ruin it. And then eventually they'll loosen back up. So that's rigor mortis. And the other big one is livor mortis. And livor mortis is the settling of blood in dependent capillaries due to gravity. So that's when there's like they're purple or red on their back. So usually it's a red, maroon, purplish skin discoloring. Importantly, any tight clothing or objects that are pushing into that dependent area will also push the blood out of that area. So you can get these like strips of white because their underwear band was there or their belt was tight against their skin. So even on that dependent, that like gravity dependent area, you can still get some bands of non-lividity because of tight clothing and tight things. And
this can be harder to see on people of color. They often show pictures of white people because it's easier to see those things. That's but true. It does happen on people of color. It's just harder to see.
That's true. And the other important thing to know is that early on, so shortly after somebody dies, this lividity is blanchable. It's just like when you push on your fingertip and it's like red and you push on it, it kind of gets white and then it goes back to being red. You can push the blood out of your capillaries and then when you let go, it'll fill up again. Same thing with this. You just have blood in these capillaries and early on, you can push the blood out of it. And then when it's been there for too long, it's quote-unquote fixed lividity, so you can no longer do that. And the other thing that lividity is really good for that I don't know if they'll test, but they might, is that lividity helps you determine if a body's, or can help you determine if a body's been moved after death.
I think they've definitely asked, like, resident in-service questions exam.
Exactly. So, like, if, you know, person died on their back, they were there for several hours, and then they were moved somewhere else and we're on their stomach, but you see this fixed lividity on their back, obviously they were moved and rolled over.
That's the most useful thing of lividity.
Yes,
not for time of death.
No, there is a little bit of a time frame in there with like fixed lividity and non-fixed lividity and that kind of thing. So like, I guess early on in death, it's a little bit more helpful, but yeah, moving is definitely the most helpful. And the only other postmortem change I'm going to briefly mention is putrefaction, and that's what, a form of decomposition. Bacteria produces gas, which causes bloating, green skin, and then within your blood vessels, especially, is where the little creepy crawlies like to proliferate, and you get this marbling, so it's kind of like your blood vessels kind of superimpose on your skin, and you can see that.
The next question I had were adipocere versus mummification.
Yes.
And we talked about this in our postmortem episode as well, but adipocere is this gray, white, waxy material that forms on bodies after prolonged exposure, so greater than 6 weeks-ish, to very wet environments. And it's also called grave wax,
which is the one of the most disgusting things ever.
And but I'm also going into this. Still planning on making candles for our merch store whenever that out of never happens.
Wax?
Yeah.
Are you gonna
not
build
out of
up
legit grave
body?
Wax? It's just gonna be called grave wax okay. candles.
I'm okay, more okay with that.
Yeah. Man, I'm going to have to charge a lot if I'm actually going to graves and exhuming bodies to get this grave wax.
I mean, worth it.
I'm not above doing it, but just kidding. I want a job in the future.
What this weird thing on your background check? Saying you used to break into cemeteries?
That was the younger me before my frontal cortex was fully developed.
I was less than 25.
Just kidding. Yeah, and so the grave wax stems from, it's commonly seen in exhumed bodies when the coffin has been breached by groundwater.
Yes.
Hashtag cremation.
Yes.
And this is in comparison to mummification, which is leathery desiccation, aka drying out of the soft tissues that's due to dry environments.
Yes.
So adipocere, wet environment. Mummification, dry environment.
I wish y'all could see these hand motions. They're great.
Yeah. Maybe we should start posting on YouTube.
Oh, no, I would have to wear real clothes.
Everybody's
if you're okay
wearing
with me just in t-shirt and shorts every time,
I mean,
we're golden.
I'm okay with it.
You are, but I mean, you people, the generic...
You folks.
What our audience would want to stare at for the hour of whatever we're doing.
Uh-huh. Well, they're staring at our hand motions.
That's true. I like that one. It's cute.
Yeah.
So do the Macarena.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- Hi! I started ahead of finish.
That's what she said.
Wow.
It was right there.
That was great. Leaving it in.
So
that's what he said. Wait, what?
So eyeballs. We're going to go back to some eyeball stuff. We're sorry. They really like eyeballs in forensics. So, as Nicole said, mummification is when you get this leathery desiccation in dry environments. There are certain parts of your body that dry out faster than others, mainly things that go across a mucous membrane. As we say, they're really good at absorbing stuff. They're also really good at drying out. You know this from, like, when you're in really dry environments and your lips start to crack, that kind of thing. So eyes are a really moist environment, and the reason they can stay that way is because we blink and we close our eyes for long periods of time. But when your eye stays open after you've died, you're naturally, your eyes aren't going to close unless somebody closed them for you. Your eye can dry out a little faster than the rest. And so you can get this black spot on the surface of the sclera, which is the white part of your eye. And it kind of looks creepy. And you could think of a lot of things. It could be, is it a melanoma? Is it like this pigmented lesion? No, it's actually something called taque noir, which is just desiccation of the eye due to them being left open. And the way you can tell if it's this often is if, like, you know, part of the eye is covered and part of it's not. If you pull the eyelid back, the part that was covered is still white, but the part that wasn't covered is black. So it's a go-to question. They love questioning postmortem changes, and that's a easy one. It's called taque noir.
Yes.
And something night, something black.
Yes.
I don't know what taque stands for.
Maybe line?
Maybe.
Or tattoo?
I don't know.
We can look it up. But we'll post a photo to social media because it is one of the classic photos that they show on tests.
Black spot of the sclera.
Oh, okay.
So I think it's French for black spot.
Nice.
Makes sense.
Cool. Yeah. And so just to emphasize that point, if the if any of the choices are postmortem artifact,
it's postmortem
artifact.
Every time.
Yeah.
Literally every time.
Yes. So the next one I had, it's essentially just trying to tell the difference between different things that can be going on around the brain. So yeah. If something is bright red, probably hemorrhage, unless it's been there for a long time and then it turns more of a yellowy color. Infection, you'll see frank pus if it's bacterial. And so that is, yeah, I mean, most people know what pus looks like. Green, viscous. Disgustingness.
This white, yellow.
Yes. And then decomp in the brain, your brain essentially just turns into mush. So
yeah, which my issue on this one, what my brain messed up on this one was the picture was a pussy exudate over the top, but there was part of me that was like, I want to feel it, because it kind of looks like what decomp can look like as well. So there's part of me that was like debating between putrefaction, because like, this is better, like actually looking at it now. So I have an electronic copy and Nicole has a real copy, and it's a little easier to see on this that it's kind of like a coating of pus around the brain, versus what I saw kind of looked more like, I don't know, for some reason it made me think more of like a decomp thing.
Yeah, I guess what was leading me away from decomp was just how solid the brain looked.
Yes, it did not look that solid on the computer.
Yeah.
Which I have now since bought a physical copy of the book, and I will only be doing it out of the physical book from now on.
Although maybe practicing looking at the computer images is better, since this is a computer-based test.
So more injury patterns. This one was essentially look at the injury, see if it reminds you of anything, and if it does, it's probably that thing. So if it kind of looks like the back of a hammer, probably the back of a hammer. If it looks like a fork, it's probably a fork. Like, if there's repeating obvious patterns, it's probably something that is that repeating obvious pattern. So for this one, it was, this is a hammer, and it, you know, the back of it looks a certain way, and the front of it looks a certain way, and if you have both of them together, the person probably got beat with a hammer. They also note police batons, because they have those, like, linear ring, or they have, like, those rings around them, so you can get, like, linear contusions that are all in a group from being impacted with a baton. Long story short, look at what you see from the injury pattern and kind of use common sense to backtrack it.
That's another big thing for this section. It's always postmortem artifact.
Mm-hmm.
Use common sense.
Yep.
Like, if they show you a picture of a crumpled car, the cause of death was not a lightning strike.
Yeah.
Probably.
Exactly. But they'll throw it in there because they can, because it's forensics and it's awesome.
Yes. So more kind of patterns or things that can help to determine circumstances. We talked about this in one of our nature episodes, I believe.
Yes.
About fire.
Fire.
So one of the important things when you have a person who was found in a fire is to determine whether or not they were alive or dead when the fire happened. So one of the most important things you can check is the airway. Airway, airway, airway.
Yep.
And this was emphasized highly in a Grey's Anatomy episode. I only mentioned because I've been binge-watching that show recently.
Nice.
Reruns.
I haven't watched that show in a hot minute.
Yeah. The old episodes are so much better than the newer ones.
The thing is, I've only seen, I think, the first 3 or 4 seasons before I went to college.
Yeah, don't watch any of the later ones.
Yeah.
They're just, like, so over-makeuped. The acting has
gotten... It seems like it turned into, like, soap opera-y.
It got very soap opera-y, and you can see the change distinctly.
I watch soap operas, but I don't watch Grey's Anatomy to watch a soap opera.
Yeah. But anyway, airway, airway, airway. So if soot is in the larynx, which is that part of your breathing tube where your vocal cords are.
You love it.
Yeah. Then the person was breathing while the fire was occurring.
Yes.
They were inhaling the smoke. And smoke inhalation leads to carbon monoxide in the blood.
Yes.
So you'll see that. And it can also cause a very distinct color change in the lividity.
Yes.
So instead of that purple red, it'll be cherry red.
Yes.
So those are some of the things you want to look for signs of smoke inhalation. So, i.e. the person was alive during the fire.
The other thing I thought was interesting was they mentioned that carboxyhemoglobin, which is a form of hemoglobin that changes a little bit more when you have more CO2 around, may be elevated, but if the person was given CPR or something, it might go back to normal.
Mm.
So it was a good point of you kind of need to know all of the steps before they were pronounced. Because
yes.
If they tried to save them, you know, they might flush something out and it's changed.
Autopsies don't happen in a vacuum.
Thank God.
Yeah, it would be hard to breathe.
Yeah, it would be. You're such a nerd. Love it.
But I'm bumped.
So this next one I really liked. Rob actually came over when I was answering this question and he looked over my shoulder and essentially it just looks like this big blue blob in the middle of this mess of other red blobs. But what it is it's a pericardial sac that's just full of blood.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like this giant blue heart sac in the middle of the body, which is what it is. So, and this one was just asking, you know, how did this person die? Or what disease does this person have? What mutation does this person have? So they like to do a lot of three-step questions. So you see this, and let's say the person randomly died. right? Nothing on the outside. And you see this heart that's full of the pericardial sac, the sac around your heart is full of blood, which means that something had to rip or tear, letting blood go into the space where it normally isn't. And one of the common ways for that can happen is what's called an aortic dissection. So the big artery that brings the blood to your whole body, essentially due to a genetic mutation and due to the fact that the vessel is no longer as intact as it should be in somebody who doesn't have the mutation, you could easily kind of tear through this giant vessel. And when you tear through it, you get blood that then goes into the area where it's not supposed to be. And then you get all this blood around the heart, which doesn't let the heart fill up, right? You can pump out, but then when you try to refill your heart, when you try to relax those muscles, technically, you can't relax because there's all of the fluid pushing in on it. So this leads to what's called cardiac tamponade, but you die because there's all this blood around the heart. And there are two main things that can lead to this. The most common above and beyond anything is going to be what's called Marfan syndrome. And I'm going to go into more specific terms just if anybody happens to be listening to this before taking the boards. This is due to a mutation in an extracellular glycoprotein called fibrillin. And because what I've noticed in a lot of these questions are like, what chromosome is a mutation on that led to this thing? Fibrillin is on chromosomes 5 and 15. Am I going to probably remember that? Probably not. If I get a what chromosome is this question on, I'm just going to take a random guess. But fibrillin is on 5 and 15, if you can remember that. The other one that can lead to this, but less commonly, is called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Those are both two connective tissue disorders. But with Marfan, the other thing with this question was, in the question stem, they described all of these other things that people with Marfan syndrome has. Mm-hmm. So you, when you go through med school, you kind of learn all of these syndromic things. And this one is, you know, a tall, thin guy with a sunken chest, long fingers, and, you know, a little bit of scoliosis. So you take all of these things, come together, you're like, well, it's probably, you know, an aortic dissection, and that's why his pericardial sac is now full of blood.
And aortic dissections aren't the only thing that cause hemopericardium.
That's true.
And other things also cause aortic dissection besides these two genetic mutations.
Yes, sorry.
Although,
that's true.
At the particular area where it causes the hemopericardium, it's more likely to be a genetic syndrome.
Exactly.
If it's like due to atherosclerosis, it's usually in the
descending aorta, the part that goes down your spine.
Yeah.
But the other thing with this question is, you know, dude was totally fine, right? Woke up dead.
And right? Had all these other things that they were pointing out.
All those other syndrome things, So they try to point you in the right direction, and hopefully you can pick up what it's putting down.
The next question was also harping on cause versus manner.
Yes.
And this one was actually pretty interesting because when I did my forensics rotation recently, the first case that I did solo was a drowning. And so I actually did the technique that they're showing here, which we've talked about this before, but drowning is one of those things we consider a diagnosis of exclusion. So you don't always find things when somebody drowns. And so it's more about the circumstances. So whatever story the death investigators were able to give you surrounding the death.
Yes.
But some of the things that you can see are fluid and or debris in the lungs, airway, and gastrointestinal tract. So like the stomach, because they swallowed it. Or you can also see fluid or debris in the sphenoid sinus, which is a hollow space in the bones around your nose.
Sphenoid.
And so there's a really thin bone overlaying the space that you can break through easily from the skull base. So when you take out the brain, you can easily pierce through this really thin bone with a needle and then see what fluid you can aspirate. So in the case that I had, we did this technique where we punctured the bone overlying the sphenoid sinus, and we pulled back fluid, and it actually had some debris in it. And the debris looked the same as what the decedent had in his mouth. He had orthodontia, so braces, and he had a bunch of silt and stuff trapped in there.
Oh, okay.
And so it looked the same as that. And then there was also some fluid and debris in his airways. So all kind of supporting the fact that he had drowned, which there was an eyewitness who had seen him drown. So it's not like this was a mystery.
Less of a question.
Yeah.
But do you trust the eyewitness?
I mean, I don't know why I wouldn't trust the eyewitness.
What if he murdered him?
I would like to believe that there's good in people. I'd like to, you know, like Anne Frank. People are good, you know? That's what I'm going to go with.
Okay.
That's not how I really am.
Let's see how long that lasts next year.
No, it's already done. People are garbage.
All right, this next one is very technical, and I apologize now for any non-medical people that are listening, because I can't really not get technical with this one. I'm going to try really hard, but I apologize. So this next one is asking about using a particular immunohistochemical stain to diagnose an injury. An immunohistochemical stain is essentially an antibody to a particular protein that, if it's expressed more, it will stain more, is the easiest way to put it. So when the protein is expressed, you can see it visually on the slide.
Yeah, we use different colors. Most of the time it's this brown color. So yes. The darker brown it is, that means it's positive for whatever.
Exactly. And generally there's a quote-unquote counter stain, which kind of stains everything else very lightly, so you can see some detail of the cells and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Like, you can see the other nuclei are stained very lightly blue, so you kind of know where you are, but the thing you're looking for is usually a darker brown. So this one is asking about something called beta amyloid precursor protein.
Say that 5 times fast.
BAP. I will call it BAP from now on.
Okay, that's easy to say 5 times fast.
So BAP essentially is used for helping transport different things along axons and nerves. That's all you need to know. And when you have certain kind, and it's normally inside and equally distributed along axons because it's helping transport things along the entire length. But when you have an injury to the axon, so an injury to the nerves, essentially what happens is that BAP protein will accumulate at that point of injury. So when you stain, instead of what would normally, you would really wouldn't be able to see it because it's kind of diffuse, it'll now be more focused. And what this can tell you is if you have some tearing or stress at a specific part within these nerves. So beta amyloid precursor protein will help you identify points of tearing or stress where you have injuries in nerves, particularly in axons. So what this question was asking is, in what situation is this immunohistochemical stain useful? Mm. And as I said, this is helpful in axonal injury. So it's helpful in determining if there's injuries to the axons. And the way these injuries can happen are either, like I said, tearing or stress. Tearing is usually trauma. So, you know, whiplash, something like that. Mm-hmm. Some kind of distinct point of trauma. And when it's whiplash, it happens in a certain distribution. So whiplash is usually seen in the pons and the corpus callosum. And then when it's due to ischemia, so when it's due to not getting enough oxygen, it's more global. So it's not just in these specific areas within the brain. So long story short, beta amyloid precursor protein helps you determine nerve injury, and the localization of that stain can help determine what kind of axonal damage there was. Does that make sense?
I mean, it makes sense to me.
Okay.
But I also reviewed this question.
Yes. I hope people understood that.
Especially because they couldn't see your hand gestures.
Oh, they were so good, guys.
Yeah. You missed out. You really did. Particularly goofy this evening.
Oh, you're welcome. That's because we're studying. The next one is going to be even worse because we'll have been studying for another month and our brains will be so much more fried.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Okay. Things to look forward to.
You're welcome.
So the next question is more practice with that range of fire. So just one word. Contact. Muzzle. Close. Soot.
Yep.
Intermediate. Stippling.
Yep.
Distant. Nada.
Nothing. Indeterminate. Eh.
Eh. Yeah. And don't confuse intermediate for indeterminate.
Yes. Good summary.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, so this next one is, again, a long, complicated one, and I'm sorry, guys.
I love that you got all the long, complicated ones. And I got drug packing versus drug stuff.
Which, to be fair, was a fun one. All right, so we also talked about this one in another episode, so I'm not going to harp on it too much, but long QT syndrome is when there's a particular segment of the heartbeat on your heartbeat monitor, the bloop, 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 bloop thing,
There's that is exactly what we should call it in hospitals.
Can you bring me the bloop bloop machine?
Yeah. I'm on the bloop bloop floor.
Done. It's called the QT segment. And the longer your QT segment gets, when it gets past a certain point, you are more likely to drop out of a normal sinus rhythm and go into some kind of dysrhythmia. And usually in long QT, it's ventricular fibrillation, which is when the bigger
chambers.
Chambers, thank you. I was going to call them compression sacs.
I like that better. I like that so much better.
When the bigger chambers of your heart contract to, you know, push the blood out into your body, essentially those larger chambers are now just kind of randomly firing, and they're called fibrillating because the muscles are kind of just fibrillating? Just tweaking out.
Yeah.
They're tweaking
out.
And
your large compression sacs are tweaking out.
They're rewriting the Wikipedia page.
Doing it right now.
And the important thing is there is an acquired form of this, and the acquired form can either be dominant or recessive. And these are usually due to potassium channels, sometimes sodium channels. And these syndromes, the ones that, if I say it and it helps you remember it, Romano-Ward is the most common, and then Jervell-Lange-Nielsen is the less common of the most common ones. Romano-Ward is autosomal dominant, Jervell-Lange is autosomal recessive. And what I thought was interesting is Romano-Ward is like inheriting one copy of these genes, and Jervell-Lange is inheriting two copies of the same genes. Hmm. So essentially it's just way worse.
Yeah.
Because you don't have anything functional. And then the important thing with this is you can also have acquired versions of long QT, which this one I got wrong when I was going through it because I didn't actually know what caused acquired, because I knew that I was able to rule some of them out. But apparently, liquid protein diets can lead you to acquired long QT. And other things that you can get long QT are drugs. Drugs can do anything. Electrolyte abnormality, which makes sense. Yeah. Your heart is a balance of electrolytes. And if they're off kilter, your heart will get messed up.
I mean, your whole body is a balance
of electrolytes. Yeah, that's true. Tiny capacitors.
Yeah.
Toxic substances, no surprise there. Hypothermia, your body keeps really close regulations of temperature because that's really important. And then these kind of lump together anorexia nervosa and liquid protein diets. Mm. I don't know exactly how mechanistically they work, but that's how it works.
I mean, I think anorexia nervosa makes sense because don't your electrolytes get all messed up?
Oh, that's
maybe
true.
With liquid protein diets, your that's electrolytes probably the same also thing. Get messed up.
Yeah, I guess with TPN, if you think about TPN, which is total parenteral nutrition, which is when you're only fed through an IV, mm-hmm. they have to keep really close track of your electrolytes. So that makes sense. Actually, that would be the same
That's
thing.
That's a good way of remembering
it. They all lead back to electrolytes. And cardiac disease leads to the greatest number of deaths in the U.S. We know this. Sudden cardiac disease is the second highest, only to total deaths from all cancers combined. Very common. Mm. And of people with underlying cardiac disease, 30% have an initial presentation that's characterized by sudden cardiac death, which is death within an hour of onset. So that means a lot of people that end up dying of cardiac disease had no idea that they had underlying cardiac disease at all.
Yeah, until they were dead.
Exactly.
And then they don't know because they're dead.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
And the other important point on this for test taking, nobody else ever needs to know this, is when you're looking at slides, you get this something called contraction band necrosis. So essentially all muscle cells have these, or any skeletal muscle cell has these striations, cardiac and skeletal muscles have these striations, and you lose those cross striations, and then you kind of get these eosinophilic, which means red bands that are perpendicular to the orientation of the myocytes, which is the muscle cells. So you'll get what's called contraction band necrosis. So you'll get these red bands that are perpendicular to the cell.
Well, we also need to know them for our actual careers.
We need to know them for that. But in terms of people that are taking this for the AP test and never need to see it again.
Yep.
And the other important thing is when this is an acquired thing, so obviously inherited, you need to be on a DFib for the rest of your life to try to track this. But when it's acquired, this will, your cardiac function will return to normal when you remove that inciting factor. So this question was asking essentially, you know, what acquired forms of long QT can you get? And it listed a bunch of the inherited forms, yeah. Which were not right.
So the next one goes back to guns. And this one, I also found, like, confusing word-wise.
Yes, same. Yeah. Because the way the picture was oriented is what also bothered me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I ended up getting it, but I had to, like, turn it around in my brain.
I did not end up getting it, but... Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Well, this is looking at exit versus entrance wounds, but specifically on the skull, which have very characteristic defects where the bullet enters and exits, because the skull is round and has these two layers of bone, essentially.
Wait, what?
Yeah. On the skull, the hole where the bullet hits initially is smaller than the defect where the bullet exits.
Yes.
So it is what I call the cone of force. So whenever I get a question like this, I actually draw a little bullet and then a cone coming out of it.
Okay.
So when you're looking at an entrance wound, the circle on the outside will be smaller, and then the circle on the inside will be larger. And then when you're looking at an exit wound, same thing, the circle on the inside will be smaller, and the one on the outside will be bigger, but it's like which one is on the inside of the skull versus what's on the outside of the skull. This is very hard to explain using just words.
Yes.
So definitely we'll be posting a photo.
Essentially, the first surface the bullet hits is smaller than the second surface the bullet hits.
Yes. But the reason why I found this question particularly confusing is because they're showing the inside of the skull.
Yes.
They're showing the larger defect of an entrance wound. So I knew it was an entrance wound, but they're showing the exit of that entrance wound.
Oh,
so I said that it was an exit because it is an exit. It's where the bullet exited where...
Yes, you know. No, I definitely had to think about this for a while and I was like, all right, well, that is an entrance wound to the body, which is what I thought of it as.
Yeah.
So the lesion depicts an, you know, an entrance gunshot wound to the body.
Right, but it's the exit of the entrance, which is what
I guess I was thinking
me.
About the wound in general.
I see.
Yeah, I definitely was also thinking of, like, am I looking out? Or yeah, it took me longer than it should have. The other way that I think of it, and this may help or may confuse you even more, is I think of it as like an arrow. Like if you stick an arrow in, it points to where the bullet's coming from.
Oh.
So, like, you know how, like, an arrow has the angles on both sides?
Yeah.
Where the arrow fits into, it's pointing to where the bullet came from.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
If that helps people. Sometimes it totally will not, but... The thing that the bullet hits first, smaller hole.
Yes.
The surface it hits second, larger hole. Yeah. And the reason that this works is because while the skull is round, it has surfaces that are relatively flat.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what bullets will do if they go through a window or a door or something like that.
Yes.
It's the same type of thing.
So the next time you're walking past a 7-Eleven, look at the bullet holes and you can tell.
You'll know if they were shot into or out of the 7-Eleven.
Yes. It's a fun game.
We are weird.
Yes.
We have weird games that we play. All right. So I also got all the brain questions somehow.
I have the one about bacterial meningitis.
That's true.
I have the pus brain.
I get all the cells in the brain.
You do.
Worst. Okay, this one is pretty, is trying to be straightforward. So, quick and dirty on this one, red neurons equal dead neurons. So, if you see a really what's called eosinophilic or red-looking cytoplasm on a neuron or a brain cell, one of the brain cells, it's dead. It has died. It does not have oxygen, and so it died.
R.I.P.
And what this question is essentially going for is, like, you know, this man, you know, overdosed. What complication from the acute intoxication did he have? And you need to look at this and see these red dead neurons and know he didn't get oxygen. So you look through the questions and you're like, which one does not have oxygen? And there's like, hemorrhage or acute ischemic. He overdosed on heroin. He didn't bleed. So it's the acute ischemic changes. Things that are important to know are certain areas of the brain are quote unquote starved of oxygen or have more sensitive neurons than other parts of the brain. And the key learning point from this one, I think, is that the hippocampus, which is the one that looks like a little seahorse, is the most sensitive. So if you're looking for hypoxia or lack of oxygen, the hippocampus is the place to look first, because it's just particularly sensitive and you'll see these red dead neurons faster. And in heroin overdoses in particular, the respiratory center of the brain shuts down slowly, which stops breathing, which is how people die of heroin overdoses, because they stop breathing. So everybody dies eventually, but the direct mechanism.
Yeah.
This one also had some fun words that I figured Nicole wouldn't let me get away without attempting to pronounce. So I actually looked these up because they were not... I don't even remember if they were in the thing. So, état criblé is the dilation of the cerebral periarteriolar spaces within the basal ganglia. Associated with chronic vascular ischemia. So essentially what this means is when you're looking on MRI, which is a type of imaging, you'll have essentially the dilation of these particular arteries. So this is état criblé is something that's seen on imaging. And then état lacunaire are small little cystic infarcts within the deep white matter. And this is due to chronic ischemia. Ooh. So old people that have repeated bouts of like weakness, gait disturbances, incontinence, essentially there's like all these tiny little ischemic events that are happening that are like you're losing little parts of your brain. But lacuna are, you know, little, you know, dead areas of your brain. So état lacunaire is just like chronic ischemia. And both of these I think of as old people. So huh. I don't know what état means, but I'm going to consider it old people.
Okay. So from now on. So French old people.
French old people.
Unless it's taque noir. Taché noir.
Taché noir.
So now I'm going to jump back to patterns of injury and how they can help us to determine circumstances around a death. So this one was asking about a pattern of injury that you can see in motor vehicle accidents that can help you to determine whether somebody was a passenger or a driver.
Which we did talk about in our MCP episode.
We did. So some of the things that can help you are dicing injuries. So these are cuts that are caused due to tempered glass of side windows when they shatter, and then the glass cuts you up on whatever side the side window is on. So a driver in a standard US car is going to have them on the left side of their face, while a passenger has them on the right.
Sorry.
Front side passenger. If you're in the back seat and you're on the left, then you'll have them on the left. But you know. Okay. So driver versus front seat passenger is what I'm going for. And these are variably described as abrasions or incisions. But glass is sharp, therefore I favor calling them little incisions.
Tiny incisions.
Yes. Other things.
Confetti
of incisions. Other things you can look for are seatbelt bruises or abrasions. So this is a patterned imprint that can happen when the seatbelt, you know, has a lot of pressure against the body. And in standard US cars, a driver will have the diagonal going from the left shoulder to the right hip, versus the passenger will have it from the right shoulder to the left hip.
Yes.
And then another thing that could help to determine who the driver was is a steering wheel contusion on the chest, if they have one. Although if an airbag deploys, then you're not probably going to see a steering wheel contusion.
But you might see some injuries from the airbags.
Yes. So that's another thing that you can look for to help determine who was driving.
So many things.
Yep.
But of course, an autopsy is not performed in a vacuum. So always look at other things so we can tell probably where the person was in the car when they died, but we can't tell how fast they were going. We can test to see what drugs and alcohol they had on board, but we don't necessarily like know actively what they're doing at the time. We can't tell if the passenger was like, oh, hey, look at this, and is actually the one that caused the accident, distracting objects, role of the environment, so signage, weather, lighting. There's a lot of other things that go into it that is not just determined by the autopsy itself, but we can probably tell you where they were in that car.
Yes.
Last one. This last one for me was on different types of skull fractures. And I kind of hate when the questions are like, grade this tumor or grade this degree of whatever the thing is. It's like, if I can diagnose the disease, I think that's good enough. You're expecting me to come up with the degree of the disease?
Yeah. All this stuff that you can look up in books that they're like, memorize it for this test.
And this was kind of one of those for me. So skull fractures, and particularly skull base fractures, are really important for determining mechanism of injury, particularly like high mechanism versus low mechanism of injury. And they have subtyped these things into oblivion. Like,
yeah.
There's so many categories. So things you need to know. Lafort fractures are of fractures of the facial bone, and they're associated with facial instability. Type 1 is your jaw and your nose, and type 2 also includes your eyes. So type 1 isn't as bad as type 2, and it's worse when your eyes are involved. So Lafort face.
And you have two eyes.
You have two eyes, and it's type 2. And you have one nose and one jaw.
Yeah. Okay.
So Lafort face, one jaw.
Lafort face.
Lafort face. One nose and jaw, two eyeballs.
Okay.
Now, hinge fractures.
Pneumonics.
Pneumonics. Hinge fractures are more complicated. So they are of the skull base. So like the bottom of the skull around the hole that your brainstem goes through. And there are three types of these. And number one is straight through the middle. Technically, your skull base is split into three sections. The anterior, the middle, and the posterior fossas. And those are just kind of very straightforward. So the front third, the middle third, and the back third. They are technically like split up by some anatomic points, but it's pretty obvious if you look at a skull base what those are.
Yeah, so check out a skull base today.
I think this is another one we should post a picture of.
Like, oh, yeah.
The fossas. Yes. It's actually kind of cool.
That sounds good.
Type 1 is straight through the middle. So it's straight through the middle cranial fossil, totally through the center. Pretty straightforward. Type 2 is a diagonal. So it starts from the anterior of one side and goes to the posterior on the contralateral side, or vice versa. So type 1, across the center. Type 2 is a diagonal. It'll make that cross if there were two. And then type 3 is just bilateral anterior cranial fossas. Again, I don't have a great way to remember this, but one is in the middle, straight across, two, diagonal across both, and three is the front.
Okay.
Yeah. It's kind of random. I feel like a lot of these grading things are random. Well, I probably remember this long term, eventually when I've seen enough cases, but it probably isn't going to stick. But hinge fracture is important. If you think of a hinge fracture, it's like if you can open the skull along that fracture, and it's like opening it on a hinge.
Good visual imagery right there.
So Lafort face, hinge across the base of the skull, and you can open the skull like a book.
Okay.
But don't read too much into it.
That's good. So the last one that I will be covering, and we will be covering in this episode,
yes,
is one of those like three-step question ones.
Yeah.
So they show you a picture and you have to figure out what the picture is, and then you have to figure out what caused that change in the picture, and then you have to figure out what they're asking about in relation to the disease that causes that entity.
Exactly.
So this one was like, whoa, okay, that's what you're asking me about? Anyway, we had a whole episode on alcoholism.
Yes.
Don't drink in podcast.
Cheers.
Do as we say, not as we do. So essentially, this was getting at chronic alcohol use and some of the consequences of that. So we talked about how chronic alcohol use can mess up your liver. And some of the early changes that you can see to your liver are fat deposition, what we call fatty liver or steatosis. When you are a chronic alcoholic, you can get something called low salt syndrome. And
electrolytes are important.
Electrolytes are important, and alcoholism can mess them up.
Yep.
Particularly sodium. Yes. So sodium is actually relatively stable after death versus other electrolytes like potassium, which increases as a byproduct of decomposition. And we like to use vitreous humor for electrolyte testing because it's a relatively sequestered area of the body. A vitreous being the fluid in your eyeballs. Yes, we stick a needle in your eyeballs.
Suck it all out.
Yeah. And I didn't go through the next half of the questions for the next episode, but I assume postmortem chemistry is discussed in more detail later?
Actually, not really, but we should talk about it.
Yeah, we'll talk about it next episode because it is something they like to ask about, is how the electrolytes change in your eyeball fluid over time.
Yeah.
And you
can eyeballs listen. Are very important.
Eyeballs are super important to forensic pathologists.
Yep.
So when we say we like your eyeballs, you should run. Run the other
way. Want to stab it with a needle.
Fast as you can. But, you know, low salt syndrome is just one of many things that goes wrong with your body when you are the chronic alcohol user. And not chronic alcohol use as in, like, one drink a night. Chronic alcohol use as in, like, a liter of vodka a day.
Yeah. Yeah. A six-pack a night.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Yes.
So, sodium, very stable. Potassium and glucose, not.
After death.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hopefully when you're alive, they're somewhat more stable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we hope you guys aren't bored to death quite yet.
Ha.
Ha.
Great.
You're welcome.
And this was just the first 26 questions, the teaching points from the first 26 questions of the Lefkowitz anatomic pathology book. And so...
Shout out to Lefkowitz.
Yes, thank you so much. Even though we take issue with some of the wording for some of your questions, overall
it's pretty good.
Yeah. And we're very grateful for you having made this resource for us. So in our next episode next month, we're going to be covering the other half of the forensic questions from this text.
If you have other questions that you would like us to answer, we can maybe throw them on here.
Yeah. Yeah. So
shoot them our way.
Yeah. And we hope you enjoyed this potpourri episode.
Woo.
So if you like this and any of our other episodes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe on the various podcasting platforms. It's how we get boosted up and other people learn about us.
You can visit our website at deadmendotellpodcast.com, where we linked all of our sources and our episode guide.
On Twitter, we're at deadmendo.
On Insta, we're at the Dead Tell Tales.
And our Facebook page is Dead Men Do Tell Tales Podcast.
And as always, you can send us an email through the website or directly to thedeadtelltales@gmail.com with questions, comments, concerns, saying hi. We love it all.
Pictures of your cat.
Oh, please send us pictures of your cat.
Pictures of your eyeball. Just kidding. Please don't send pictures of your eyeball.
Really creepy.
And our opening theme music is Introducing the Pre-Roll by Lee Rosevere, who you can find on SoundCloud.
So thank you guys. Good luck studying.
To everybody who is studying.
Yes.
And thanks for listening to all those who aren't studying and just want to learn more about forensics. Yay, we appreciate you, and we want you to go into the field someday to make less work for us.
Do it. Bye all.
Bye.
Oh my god, I thought that was long.
Is it an hour?
Hour 27.
Cool.